This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. MoranTechnology.com. This is Jerry Bain at the CNI 2012 Spring Meeting in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm with David Weinberger, senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and the author of the book Too Big to Know. David, can you give me a few thoughts on how your concept of networked knowledge, as described in your book, might ideally impact teaching and learning at the university level?
Education has traditionally assumed that it's something that a teacher does to improve a student. You become a better person, and we have better people, we have better society. And that's clearly the case. If you look at the network knowledge building that's going on the internet, you see something a little bit different. So if you look, for example, at how software developers learn, they have built what I think is arguably the best environment for rapid learning that humans have ever created. And, you know, maybe that's an overstatement, but it's a somewhat defensible overstatement. So if you're a programmer and you have a question, whether it's how to learn a new language or a particular problem you're having with a piece of code, you go on the web, maybe you go to a search engine, you end up on any of lots of different sites where questions are answered. People ask a question, people respond, they build on the answer, somebody puts up the actual working code, and there it is. One of the mysteries or wonders of living within a scaled environment is that the chances are small and always get smaller and smaller that you're asking a question, any particular question, for the first time. Somebody's asked it and it's been answered in one of these software development forums. So we see a few things happening here. For one thing, there's very little shame about not knowing something, which is great. You know, you ask a question, it can be a stupid question, you'll still get a good answer. You're getting collaborative answers in which people build upon. Many of these systems have voting, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down for answers, but people will correct. It's conversational and say, well, no, there's a better way of doing it, or and so forth. And people contribute code very generously. This is a very generous environment. And the reason why I think this is a particularly interesting sort of example is that it's an example of learning that's done in public. When you learn something, it should not just make you better, it should make the public sphere better, make the next person better as well. That's something that I think maybe will eventually, as the new generation becomes the old generation, that maybe we'll see change. That is, rather than thinking that education is this private activity that occurs in a classroom, increasingly perhaps it will be something that if the act of education, of learning, is not making the public better as well, then it's a little bit selfish. So that's one thing. Another, of course, is the open access movement, in which we are seeing scholars and scientists and researchers, more so in some areas than in others, but accepting the idea that publishing in a journal that does not provide open access, that in fact locks people out because they don't have access to a university library that can afford the $20,000 a year subscription, that doing that is an act of selfishness. At this point, it does advance your career because the tenure committees and so forth are looking at those closed access journals. But it's a selfish act. And if the ethos becomes such that writing for closed access journals is seen as selfish, then we'll see a massive and perhaps sudden shift in our understanding, and open access will become the norm, which I think is a wonderful, wonderful thing for knowledge and for science, research and for learning. The parallel between the closed access journals and the recording industry is that the recording industry ceased adding value. We don't need them for distribution, for sure. We don't need them for manufacturing. Maybe we need them as filters, although their job of filtering, choosing who's going to get recorded, they don't have a great record doing that, so to speak. Maybe we need them for marketing, but that's not really clear either. So here's an industry that has basically ceased adding at least much value, but retains control and a huge chunk of the profits, a huge slice of what the artists get.
Could you tell me a little bit about the Harvard Library Innovation Lab? Who uses it and what kinds of projects are taking place there?
So it's a small group of developers and a web designer, innovator guy, a little hard to describe. And we have the luxury of existing in order to develop software and some non-software as well, but primarily we're doing software that is both useful and helpful to the library system and to its users, but also can simply be a spark for thinking, that is, be innovative. So we have a lot of, it's wonderful, we have a lot of freedom to develop things. And so we've developed some very large projects. One of them is called Shelf Life, and it's a visual browser for the 12 billion volumes in the Harvard library system that allows you to see an item, a book typically, or DVD or whatever, on the shelf that you would see it in the actual physical library. But it's actually doing a join across all 73 libraries in the system, but then also to pivot on a work so that if you want to see it not in its call number order, but clustered with other objects that have been categorized in the same way or that are user favorites and so forth, you can just click and it will show you that shelf. So that's one large project. Another large project was Library Cloud, which is a metadata server. And much of what we learned from Library Cloud is we are applying to the Digital Public Library of America platform that two of our developers are working pretty much full time on. Another is, at a different scale, is the Awesome Box.
That sounds kind of fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. So the Awesome Box is a physical box that is designed so that when a user comes into the library and she's holding a book, about to return a book that she thought was awesome, she puts it into that box instead of into the inbox. And we're now doing a little work with Arduinos to get some LEDs to light up and, you know, a little sparkly effect. And the book gets scanned a second time and gets entered into a list of recently awesome books.
That's awesome.
I love the Awesome Box. How can you not like the Awesome Box?
In a statement on your blog last month, you said, quote, "Libraries are a statement of a community's commitment to the 99%. Could you expand on that?
Well, so that was an aphoristic way of saying something that I think people generally already understand, which is that local libraries in towns generally are central and good-looking buildings or impressive buildings. And frequently, in the old days, that meant Greek columns, and these days it means something else, more glass. But you know, they are something the town builds in order to not only get all the services that local libraries provide, but to say to the world that this is a town that cares about library values, learning, curiosity, truth, knowledge, all those things. And libraries, public libraries, are open and free in a way that very few institutions in this country are. They are, therefore, for the 99% who want to learn, explore, be curious, talk together, but don't have the money to have the books shipped to their yacht. It is for the 99%.
I understand that you're involved in the Digital Public Library of America. What is your own perception of the value that project can bring to the U.S. and to the world?
So the DPLA is at a wonderful stage right now, and also sort of high-wire, scary stage as well, because it's not entirely clear what it should do. It has, I think, a great set of participants. The libraries and cultural institutions who have signed up for this and did so immediately and have done so in public is a phenomenal list. It's just a wonderful list of institutions. The overall values and aims that we should take the values of libraries, of cultural institutions, of the cultural items themselves and make them as openly and broadly accessible to as many people as possible and do so for free and in reusable ways. I mean, it's all fantastic. Now DPLA has to figure out what that means when you write software or what it will look like to users. And that's the exhilarating and scary part of it. DPLA has given itself a deadline of April 2013, so it's really, you know, for a big software project, it's coming up pretty fast. Our group, it's an interim group that's centered at Harvard, and it's a group of three developers, is tasked with building the platform. Not the front end. It's still not yet decided what the user front end, the user experience will be, and that's not what we're building. We're building what will support that, whatever it turns out to be. But we are, we're building something that I think the entire DPLA has agreed is one of the things that needs to be done, which is to provide a way for developers and for other websites and for anybody who wants to, including local libraries, provide a way for them to take maximal advantage of the distributed set of cultural items, everything that's in libraries and online and cultural collections, to make maximal advantage of that. And that the way to do that is to provide programmatic API-based access to the metadata about those items so that developers can do rich and interesting and innovative and unpredictable things. So that's what we're doing. We are gathering some big sample sets that we hope will be useful. We're trying to do that across lots of different types. So we have library catalog information. We tied to particular library holdings. We have generalized bibliographic information. We have some collections. We have collections of photos. We have some web content because we're presuming that it would be useful to have, say, TED Talks as part of this. I mean, not the whole web. We have search engines for that, but for some, you know, Google author talks seems to make sense. So we're trying to bring in a wide variety of data, all of which have different metadata attached to them. So that's a huge, huge problem. But that's why we're bringing them in, to see what can be done. We're trying to normalize the data as best we can, which, of course, is going to be not all that well, but we hope useful enough. Add some value to that metadata by, for example, clustering items, and provide an API for access to that data, we hope in useful ways, and provide it as linked open data as well. We're doing all those things, and we're also encouraging the development of applications on top of this initial data set as we go, because we only have till April 2013.
Thanks for talking to us, David.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. MoranTechnology.com.